For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, the two usual suspects, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and the semi-usual suspect, Dr. Jason Eberle. Guys, you know, everybody looks at philosophy and, you know, they say, okay, it's this dead thing. You know, we're talking about ancient history and those kinds of things. But pop culture is really filled and, you know, brimming with philosophical concepts and things like that that we generally don't even notice. Where do we look to find philosophical concepts in today's world?
Yeah, you cannot get away from philosophizing. So
no matter how hard you try.
No matter how hard you try. No, I mean, if there, you're always going to be philosophizing and thinking through issues and trying to come to some understanding of the universe around you. It's just a question of how well you do it and how disciplined you are doing it and whether you're going to be wrong about it, whether you're going to do it in a way that leads you to error.
Well, that's why I'm so grateful Dr. Jason Eberle from Marion University is here with us in the cave, because he is very astute at surveying pop culture and then helping us kind of understand. We're going to talk about how pop culture maybe presents a kind of story or narrative that we're telling ourselves that raises and sometimes tries to answer or at least explore what some of the big philosophical questions or dilemmas are. So welcome, Dr. Eberle.
Thank you. Always happy to be here and talk about fun subjects.
Okay, I want to talk about a really cutting-edge show, one that I've really, really enjoyed watching for a couple of reasons, and it's called Westworld. One reason why I've liked it is it's nostalgic for me because this is a new series on HBO, and it's based, you know, kind of on the original 1970s movie, which I remember watching as a kid and really enjoying the movie. So I love the fact that, like many shows or movies, are kind of picking up on older programming. So I like it for that reason. But I also like it because it raises lots of interesting questions. I know you've seen Westworld. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what generally for our listeners, kind of what's going on with that program.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there is this sort of television and cinematic phenomenon of resurrecting, reimagining, rebooting.
Battlestar Galactica. We talked about that on a previous show. Right. That's another example. Right, right. And which they did a pretty good job with, I will say, reimagining it. Star Trek, right? Another one? Okay. Yep.
And again, you know, some of these projects have been better than others. There was a remake a few years back of a favorite show of mine from the 60s called The Prisoner, which was not nearly as good. And Star Trek fans are very much divided about the J.J. Abrams version of the films. I like them, but Star Trek, I'm excited about the new Star Trek Discovery TV series supposed to premiere this fall. And hopefully they'll get into some deeper, more interesting philosophical things on the television show. But with Westworld, yes. So there's this, you know, a lot of criticisms of, oh, Hollywood can't, you know, come up with any new stories. It's got to resurrect old ones. But again, they're not merely resurrecting. They're not just rehashing. They're reimagining and doing so, especially on channels for like HBO or Showtime, for a more mature audience. And not just mature in the sense of people who, you know,
because they amped up the dirty language.
Right.
It's not just that, the sexual content, although there is some of that.
Yeah.
It is HBO.
Yeah, they do.
But that's not the main. That's not what you're talking about.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about mature audience in the sense of, you know, you know, people who want to think and reflect about these shows, people who want to spend time talking about, right? We used to talk about water cooler shows, right? Back in the day.
Oh, right, right, right.
You know, things where...
Bottled water killed water coolers.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, the things that you're going to want to talk about at work.
Right, right, right. Well, I couldn't agree more, because it's the complexity of the plot. They seem to do a magnificent job, too, I will say, with finding really talented actors. And then they're spending... they must be spending quite a bit of money on sets and costumes, because those are top notch. I mean, these are not low budget items whatsoever. But I'm with you. It's the plot, the complexity of the plot combined with really great actors. So, who's one of the stars of Westworld? gotcha. Anthony Hopkins.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if you were an Anthony Hopkins fan, he's phenomenal. He's sort of so. But tell us a little bit about what is the general story arc.
Yeah. So if people had seen the original 1971 film with Yul Brynner, remember that name?
Oh yeah. I couldn't remember what year the first one came out. The original movie came out. 71. Wow. Great. I must have seen it as a rerun, because I remember being about. I would have been about 10 when I saw it, which would have been around 75, 76.
Yeah, I caught one of those Saturday matinee
afternoons
on ABC.
When my parents weren't successful at kicking me out of the house, okay, you know, to play outside.
This is scary, because I remember seeing it first run at the drive-in, but, you know.
Oh, you are a dinosaur, which is a good fit for being in the cave.
So the aspect of the new series that's the same as the original film is the fact that you have this, you know, near future time, you have this fantasy world called Westworld, where people can, you know, so Western, as the name implies.
Old West. Cowboys and that kind of stuff. Okay.
And you have basically robots who are programmed to service the guests. You know, if a guest wants to get in a gunfight at a bar, they can do that. If a guest wants to rescue a damsel from marauding bandits, they can do that. That part is exactly the same. Then what the new Westworld does is it explores something that the original film didn't do, which is, well, what about these robots? Do they become conscious of their experience? Are they aware of what's going on? Because the idea is that, okay, so you're this robot, you're programmed to, you know, have this interaction with the guest, whether it's, you know, violent or sexual or something else. And then your memory's wiped, and then, you know,
you're put back in action.
You're put back in action. So you can be shot and killed by a guest, and then you're repaired, your memory's wiped, and you go back in as if nothing happened. But at some point, do memories start lingering?
Right. Oh, yeah. It sort of haunts them, right? And it raises, I think, very interesting issues around, like, you know, are they sentient? Are they conscious? But another one that kind of jumps out at me, too. So since this whole show is kind of based on, one of the things that's going on is, here is this really expensive sort of amusement theme park where you get to step into a character in this old West setting, but and then you're free to indulge whatever desires you may have. So if you want to be a quote unquote good guy, you can do that. But if you want to be a cutthroat killer, which there is one in the program, you're free to act out on your most violent base instincts, right, or desires on these robots, right? And so there's kind of a there's what are these robots that appear to be becoming sentient? Mm-hmm. What are they experiencing? But also there's also this issue of creating a setting in which human beings can go fulfill any fantasy, no matter how dark or evil it may be.
Yeah, to me that's the
and giving them the tools to do it.
Right, to me, that's the most interesting aspect of the show. I mean, the artificial intelligent thing has been done to death.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying Westworld doesn't do it very well and introduce some new nuances on that. But yeah, it's the fantasy world aspect I find really interesting. Robert Nozick, since we're the Catholic cave, we got to bring in some philosophy.
Yes. Harvard.
Yeah.
Is he from Harvard? Yeah. I think I read some of his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, wrote a famous book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, back in the late 70s. And one of the things he talks about in that book is he talks about this thought experiment of what he calls the experience machine. He says basically, you know, what if we could be plugged into this machine willingly, Not like the Matrix at first, forced right? to. Right?
At first. It always starts willingly at first.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we program the machine to give us whatever experience we want, right? And whatever pleasures you want to experience, you'll experience. And he uses this to make an argument against hedonism by saying, look, we are not built just to be pleasure seekers. None of us should, no rational agent should choose to plug into the experience machine. And there's several reasons he gives. And one of them is that we want to be a certain type of person. We want to cultivate a certain type of moral character. And the machine, which he characterizes as a very passive experience, just giving us pleasures, won't do that.
Yeah, you're just kind of laying there while mentally things are happening.
Exactly. Now, Westworld, of course, is different. You're physically doing things. It's very much not a passive experience. You are making choices. And again, as you mentioned, choosing to indulge your base desires, your base pleasures. And some might see this as, okay, this is an outlet for your pleasure, so you can go back into the real world and be an upright, upstanding citizen, model husband and father, mother and wife. But actually, I think it's a way of not releasing pent-up desires or tensions, but actually you're cultivating a certain type of character. So I think
it starts turning you into your right. base exactly. desires when you let them loose and indulge them, right?
And I think the character of Ed Harris, one of the other major actors in the show, his character very much
he wears all black audience. So right. yeah, I mean, he is a bad guy.
I was gonna say, he's always playing bad guys. Ed Harris, for whatever reason, he gets cast as that sort of bad
he's pretty
guy.
Good at it. And yeah. His character too, I think, is it's written such that he's a, you know, kind of top level rich corporate executive that has come to Westworld like annually for 20 years, and he wields a big Bowie knife that he uses to kill, you know, these, you know, the robots, you know. But again, they don't look like robots. They look like flesh and blood human beings, and he's there to create all kinds of havoc and mayhem, and just he's a very dark, sinister character in that. And so I think that begins to illustrate your point, Dr. Eberle, about he seems like he's given over to now he's given himself over to these base. He's more this sinister character in Westworld, more his now true self, if I might say, versus his other, you know, identity before he started going to this, a person in the real world.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. The more, as someone who is rich enough and part owner of Westworld, he's able to go in whenever he wants, do whatever he wants. And granted, he's not just being, I'll avoid any spoilers, but he's not just being randomly mischievous and mayhem causing. There's an emotional drive to what he's doing.
But I think he's plotting and planning and then executing against his plans, exactly. Which is just really disturbing to me when I watch the show. Every time he comes on screen, I'm like, this can't be good.
You know? And speaking of plotting and planning, this is where we plan to take a break, and we'll be right back with more of The Catholic Cave right after this.
I've got the spirit.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, Dr. Jason Eberle from Marion University, Professor of Medical Ethics. But today, we're not talking medical ethics per se. We're talking pop culture, and we've been talking about the new HBO series Westworld because it raises all sorts of interesting ideas and concepts and moral dilemmas and questions of agency and things like that. Here's one for you. I got a question for you, Dr. Eberle, relative to that. So Westworld, a big part of the plot, where it all kind of takes place, is this kind of theme park for adults, right? What do you think, what might be some of the, it's based on fantasy and living out fantasies. What do you think might be some of the dangers of indulging our, say, our more base fantasies?
Well, I think as we were talking in the last segment, you know, a huge, you know, concern is that we're not simply indulging in a sense of like there's something inside we need to release and get out. Once it's out, it's out. You know, our actions determine our character, right? Aristotle says that we cultivate virtues and vices, moral virtues and vices, through habitual action. And granted, if one went to Westworld, you know, once, twice in their life, they're not necessarily cultivating a habit, but you still got to question what is, you know, what is driving them to want to indulge in these fantasies and so
right. on. Why do they right. think it's a good idea to go someplace where you can experience a very lifelike murder, yeah. you know, or well, something like that? It's horrible.
Well, the whole setup seems like it's putting to the test the question of, you know, some sort of virtue-based ethical system like Aristotle or St. Thomas Aquinas would lay out, or some type of consequentialism, you know, like you'd come from, I don't know, Moore or Sidgwick or you know, any of the more, I guess, modern moral philosophers that are out there. It's kind of creating a philosophical experiment to kind of see, okay, how does morality work? Is it more virtue-based where, yeah, as you said, as you do this, you're going to be cultivating habits, good or bad habits? Or is this more of a, you know, morality and ethics are more based on sentiment and emotion, and so these are things we've just got to get out of our system so that we can go back to living good, moral, healthy lives.
And in fact, even folks like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas struggle with that question, even though they're both clearly virtue theorists and not emotivists. The case of Westworld reminds me of the case where Augustine talks about the tolerance, not approval, to be clear, but the tolerance of prostitution. And he thought, and of course this is, you know, fifth century psychology, which doesn't hold water today, but he thought it would be a way for men who might otherwise turn to violence against them, turn to rape, to have an outlet for their sexual passions. Again, he's not saying this is a good idea or, you know, should do it, but he saw it as kind of a quote, necessary evil, we might say. And you see, kind of see Westworld functioning in that modern sense, in that version.
Right, but the show doesn't go that direction.
I mean, it definitely is premised on the idea that it's okay for people to go and let out their passions.
But
I
guess the show starts to explore what kind of effects that has on people and on society.
Right.
I guess yeah. in a way that kind of steers it a little bit more towards an idea of virtue ethics.
Oh, no, I agree. Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize that's where you're going. Yeah, I do think it does, especially when you can see the development of Ed Harris's character, and there's a big plot twist there I won't reveal, but you definitely see the evolution of his character very much teaching that moral lesson.
I also think it raises, going back to Anthony Hopkins' character, it raises some interesting questions around controlling other people. So Anthony Hopkins is sort of the genius behind the creation of the robots that are so lifelike, including, of course, things like emotion. So not just physically, they look like human beings, they bleed, they seem to have, you know, their skin's warm to the touch, and they're, you know, there's lifelike as you might imagine. And then this issue of them also sort of becoming sentient, right? Becoming self-aware. But he's always ultimately in control of them. And to me, it raises kind of issues going back to, say, Brave New World, where in that setting, in Adolphus Huxley's book, society is stratified by different, on purpose, genetically engineered different classes of people.
Alpha, betas, gammas, and deltas.
Right. There you go. Yeah, to perform different things. And so it seems to me that a way in which Westworld is raising an issue is, you know, we're increasingly seeing in our society, but the West writ large, more and more in terms of like genetic engineering, opening up possibilities, many with the presumed intent of finding cures, treating illnesses, things like that. But also, as that door is swung open, other things are coming through that door too, like, you know, parents' preferences, preferencing certain characteristics or traits in children and sort of ordering them, human cloning. And then once you start this idea, I don't know if you saw this too. I'm pretty sure a couple of weeks ago, the Ukraine successfully cloned a human being. I think I saw that. So
I didn't see that.
I'm going to defer to you. I'm probably mistaken, but there's efforts underway, right? I mean, this could happen anytime. And it raises issues of if someone somewhere, some group of scientists, geneticists wind up cloning human beings or producing human beings for the sake of what? That's kind of the question. Is it to what one might see creating using artificial in vitro fertilization, for example, which is pretty common use now, to create children for parents that otherwise maybe wouldn't be able to have children. But what about this notion of sort of creating human beings for other purposes other than family life?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the main purpose that one would think of in that respect is biomedical research. So one of the, 1998 scientists isolated human embryonic stem cells, which launched that whole debate, led to President George W. Bush putting a ban on federal funding for that type of research. President Obama, one of his first executive orders, overturned that. And the purpose of cloning, I mean, aside from a few whack scientists, no one's really interested in cloning a human being in the sense of a born baby that's my child or something.
Another me, a mini me.
Right. Which, of course, they wouldn't be because they would be a distinct human organism from a Thomistic perspective. They'd have a different rational soul than yours.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But they might be treated, they might be recognized as such. But the cloning technique called somatic cell nuclear transfer, the scientific goal is to be able to create embryos from which stem cells could be harvested, which of course the Catholic Church is against. But the idea is to do it that these cells would then say have my DNA. So if we clone embryos from me, and let's say one day I need a liver,
then we could
grow a liver potentially out of stem cells from embryos that are my clones, and that reduces the risk of transplant rejection because it's basically my own liver coming back to me, genetically speaking.
So going down that path, we probably couldn't just grow a liver, at least not initially, right? I mean, the path you'd have to go down probably with that technique, wouldn't you have to kind of grow the whole human being and then just pull out the liver? You could just grow the liver?
Right. Yeah. The idea would be to harvest the stem cells and then use those stem cells and manipulate them and try to coax them into being liver cells.
Just a liver?
Right. Now
doing that...
Good Lord, that sounds gross.
Now doing that completely outside of an organism where your question's coming from?
Yeah. Like in a Petri dish is what's popping in my head or the clear jar, like Dr. Frankenstein had, where there's... It's growing in this bubbling, clearish liquid. Yeah, that's not what's happening. That's stuck in the past.
I mean, the idea is that's kind of where scientists would want to be able to do it. In the meantime, it's not about, again, cloning whole human organisms and harvesting their livers. It would be then taking these stem cells that have been created from my clones and grafting them into, say, a pig.
And have
the pig grow my liver. Then we kill the pig, and I got some bacon and a liver.
Excellent. Oh, that's crazy. Well, I want to maybe advance the conversation a little bit past Westworld for a minute. I know at Marion University you recently had a film that you guys showed and then invited a panel discussion to discuss. Tell us a little bit about that, Dr. Eberle.
Yeah. So the Center for Organizational Ethics at Marion and the Luger Franciscan Center for Global Studies, Drs. Karen Speer, Drs. Pierre Atlas, who run those, as well as myself. This is the second time we've kind of collaborated on doing a film screening with some sort of discussion, raising issues of ethics, of global policy, things of that nature. The first film we did, which was a little over a year ago, was Crimson Tide.
That was a great movie.
And so we had a panel with us as well as one of our colleagues who is retired from the Navy, and her husband, who's a retired colonel from the Army. And so you know, they were able to talk about the military aspects, and then we had the ethical aspects, and then we had the global political and analysis from Dr. Atlas. So this year, we chose a recently released film called Eye in the Sky.
Oh, that's a great film.
Right, Helen Mirren, right?
Yeah, Helen Mirren. Yeah, really, really wonderful cast. And Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. And basically, it's about the ethics of ordering a strike, in this case, a drone strike, but it wouldn't really matter if this was, I mean, this could have been World War II and a pilot dropping a bomb.
Airstrike
but,
of some
yeah,
sort.
But here it's obviously a much more precision strike with our current technology and the ability to see, you know, from around the world. So you have people in Great Britain, you have people in America. It's a joint strike operation between British and the U.S. And they're attacking this house, just a regular house in the neighborhood, but it's a terrorist stronghold. And it's not just that there happen to be terrorists there. It's that they're actually arming up. They got a little bug inside that can see with the camera, and they see that the terrorists are actually putting on vests. They're putting the C4 explosives, and so they order this missile strike. But it's in a crowded neighborhood area,
so there's going to be a lot of collateral damage.
That's the key word throughout the film, and particularly focused on a little girl who sells bread at her little kiosk right outside the wall of this compound where the terrorists
innocent.
Are.
So there's a clearly...
A clear innocent who, again, they do the analysis and they're like, well, 65% chance she's going to be killed. And that's too high. But then they have this ethical debate. Yeah, but these terrorists who are arming up...
Right.
They go...
Yeah.
And
there's the urgency.
Exactly.
And the threat.
They could kill lots of little girls.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think with that, it raises maybe... For us as Catholics, you know, we have a just war theory tradition. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what that looks like.
And we'll talk about that right after a break.
Three things keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. One is our fervent desire to spread the gospel message. Two is your donations to the station. We couldn't survive without them. And three is underwriting from area businesses. Every month, these businesses make donations to the station. Please support them. Visit their stores, send them an email, or call them. Let them know that you appreciate their support of Catholic Radio. It's a great way to thank our underwriters for their very important support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. This is Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave is, of course, Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford, and Dr. Jason Eberle. And we've been talking pop culture films as a way to get at some important philosophical themes. Right before this last break, we began to talk about the movie Eye in the Sky, which has led us to bring up the subject of just war theory. So if you would, Dr. Eberle, tell us a little bit from a Catholic perspective. What is just war theory? What constitutes it? And what are ways we want to think about that? Obviously, there's tons of stuff going on globally, a lot of conflict, even as we speak. So how might we think about what's the proper justifications for a nation like the United States to engage in warfare?
Yeah. And so, you know, the first point is exactly what you just said. Just war theory, which is for centuries been part of the Catholic moral tradition, and something which not just Catholics, but others have utilized to justify engaging in war, right?
Limited to Catholics.
Right. It's not limited to Catholics, even though it's grounded.
Like anything Catholic. It's for everybody. That's right. What Catholic means, universal.
Exactly. but like I said, it's for nations to engage in war, right? This isn't about me or a local gang deciding to do something.
Right.
Actually, my book on the TV show Sons of Anarchy and Philosophy, one of our authors made an argument that the motorcycle club and the various other gangs they interact with could count as nations.
And therefore they are justly authorized to
engage
in war.
Yep. but that gets off track. That's why I want to make a plug for Sons of Anarchy. Great show. For nations to engage in war, which again was happening in the film Eye in the Sky. And so there's basically two main aspects of just war theory. And we, being Catholic, of course, we're going to use Latin terms for this. Mm-hmm. So jus, J-U-S, or sometimes spelled I-U-S, pronounced use, justice, rightness. Right. There's, first of all, jus ad bellum, justice, rightness in going to war. Jus ad bellum.
Right.
And basically your criteria there are that you have to have, first of all, a just cause, a good reason to go to war. And you have to have exhausted all other peaceful options.
So it's a last resort.
It's a last resort. And then finally, you have to have a reasonable chance of success. There's no point going to war if...
Just to lose.
Just to lose, right? Right. I mean, you're, and throwing those lives
away.
Because
it's going to be even worse. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, and that, you know, and in our war on terrorism, you know, I think that's an actual, you know, that's a point of debate. I think that can be debatable on both sides. To what extent do we really have a chance of eradicating global terrorism, making a dent in global terrorism? You know, what is the scope of the warfare that we're taking on? Are we going after just ISIS, just Al-Qaeda, trying to contain those? Or is our global, you know, war on terrorism more expansive than that? To which, yeah, then you do question the ability for us to succeed.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, I mean, this goes back to, you know, after 9/11, obviously, we were, once we discovered that it was Al-Qaeda responsible, and we knew the Taliban was harboring them in Afghanistan, no one really had, you know, unless one was an avowed pacifist, no one had a problem with our rooting out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, toppling the Taliban, right? Because they're the ones who attacked us. There's your just cause. Right. Again, you know, question about success and so on, a whole different part of the equation, right? And then when the Bush administration, you know, wanted to push for going to Iraq, you know, people may recall that action was actually denounced by St. John Paul II, and partly because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And, you know, we all know the story and everything and the evidence that was presented that and the weapons of mass destruction. But the big point of debate from a philosophical perspective, avoiding the politics, was it was arguably a preemptive strike. It's like Iran is developing it. We need to strike before they, whereas right. attacking Al-Qaeda was responsive. And that's a debate among just war theorists. That debate was already existing prior to the Iraq war, but definitely that re-engaged that debate among just war theorists about, yeah, can one engage in preemptive strike? And then you have the epistemic question, how strong does your evidence have to be?
Right. And, you know, another aspect of just war that I think comes into question is very debatable is the idea of authority, justified authority. You know, just war theory classically says you are allowed to conduct warfare if you are sort of the authorized authority. And so when you're talking about nations...
So you and I can't.
Right, exactly.
Right,
first off, right, you and I can't, yeah. Right, as Dr. Oberl said, you know, this is for governments, right? So this is for governments. And but even within that, you've got a question of, is it the United States' prerogative responsibility to try to root out terrorists in another government? You know, a government that's justly composed, you know, this isn't a situation of a rogue government or anything. You know, this is a recognized state that's recognized by the rest of the world. Are we authorized as a foreign country to go in kind of uninvited to root out terrorists in this other country? And I think that's another huge kind of question that comes up when you look at just war theory and you look at these particularly drone strikes, which are, you know, highlighted in this Eye in the Sky movie.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, to bring us back to Eye in the Sky, right. The key is, so we had the jus ad bellum, and then this film and your question really relates to the other aspect of it, jus in bello, justice within the conduct of war. So you have a justified reason to go to war, but how are you conducting that war?
Yeah, how do you prosecute it?
How do you prosecute it, exactly?
And there's limits.
And there are limits. And, you know, everyone's heard the Geneva Convention and things like that. So we have, you know, international laws that, again, have derived to define what constitutes jus in bello.
Right.
And one of the key things is, well, you're not going to target innocent civilians.
Right, right.
You know, even to attack terrorists, you can't become a terrorist yourself. Or, as Mark, you know, alluded to, you know, interfering with the sovereign rights of another nation.
Right.
Well, I think the other along those lines, right. So we're prohibited from when prosecuting. So we're engaged in warfare. We're prohibited from directly and intentionally targeting innocent non-combatants, really, right. Non-combatants. And of course, when fighting terrorists, it's harder and harder to tell, right? Because people, there's not a battlefield per se.
They're not wearing uniforms.
And they're not wearing uniforms, right. And it's no longer limited to gender either, although it's predominantly still male. But increasingly, there's female and even children at times have been used, right? Especially with a suicide bomber as a tactic. The other, I think, thing worth mentioning or aspect or requirement of prosecuting a just war is proportionality, right?
So you can't, just to bring that up.
You can't. So we have a lot of nuclear weapons. So we can't just drop, right? We're talking about using a drone strike in the movie, which is, a very powerful weapon, a missile, a guided missile, but it's not a thermonuclear weapon, right? No one's debating. No one even thinks that, well, we probably should just nuke it and then just take out the whole neighborhood, right?
Oh, interesting. The missile is named, the type of missile is a Hellfire.
Oh, yes.
Very apocalyptic.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to rain Hellfire down on you.
Right. Well, and one of the things too, I think that comes up in drone warfare per se, just to narrow the conversation for a moment, I've heard questions raised around we're now being very far removed. Our combatants are now very far removed from the violence of warfare, and sometimes it's the violence where you've had enough. Right. Where you're like, that's where you begin to sue for terms of peace, surrender, things like that, because you've had enough of the violence that is warfare. Right. But now we have, I know in the United States, a few things, I think my facts are right here. We now have more, we're now each year we're acquiring more unmanned aircraft than manned aircraft. And we now have each year we're graduating more drone pilots than we are pilots who are actually in aircraft. And so we've shifted, there's this big, or transforming into this. So now the person who can engage in warfare in Yemen, say we want to do a drone strike in somewhere in Yemen, you're sitting in somewhere in a remote Air Force base in Nebraska, and you're the Air Force drone pilot, and then you're operating this drone, unmanned aircraft, which unleashes this Hellfire missile to cause the destruction, and then you basically can go home, and you're completely, you don't have the sight, the sound, the smells of combat, right, on you anymore. You simply have a visual, you're contending with a visual representation, maybe the moral weight of it, but that seems to me like it presents more akin to, and this might be unfair on my part, But I'm wondering if there isn't a risk that we sort of, there's a gamification of that, that if comes across more like a video game, sort of surreal, versus the horror of war is somehow, we're too far removed from it, maybe.
Right. No, I think that's a very interesting point. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of one of our favorite pop culture topics, Star Wars.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, George Lucas, you know, created, you know, there's this romanticism about using the lightsaber. Honorable combat.
Yes.
Where, again, you are engaged in close personal combat with your enemy, and you're going to see the immediate effects of slashing them, you know, chopping off their hand or something. Whereas guns, you know, firing from a distance, the Death Star.
Oh, right, right.
Firing,
right.
You know, you don't even
across
see
the galaxy fire. Or something. Exactly. Right, right.
So I think that's a very astute point you're making. The one interesting thing, again, about Eye in the Sky is that, yes, this is that situation, right? Drone pilot, you know, removed from the situation. No, it's not. He's not being fully centrally engaged in what he's doing. Yet, the visual, because of the technology and because you got these little cameras, and it's the movie
faces.
Eye in the Sky. Yeah, he can see. So it's almost like there was this middle ground between, because think of if you're flying an F-16 or an F-18 now, I guess, or an F-35, and you're just up in the air, and you deliver the target package. Here's your coordinates. Release your missile. You're not going to at all see. I mean, you're
not even going to see the smoke.
You're
the 35.
Yeah, right. You're 35,000 feet in the air.
Right. Stealth bomber.
And the
drone.
And so the drone pilot, even though they're physically at more of a distance, at least the way it's depicted in Eye in the Sky, and from the military people on our panel, we were told it was pretty accurate of what the pilots can see and so on. They are actually pretty up close and personal. They can see the little girl who's going to be killed by their missile. So the technology, which had once removed us, has kind of come back around to bring us right back into the center of the action, even more intimately than even before.
Right. And, you know, I think one of the central issues, whether you're talking about distance or proximity, is the idea of depersonalizing your enemy. And, you know, this goes on in, I think, every war, every theater where, you know, to psychologically justify our warfare, we do things to try to depersonalize those we're in combat with. And drone strikes, on the one hand, by creating that geographic distance where we can go home at night and spend time with our families after going to war, you know, that helps to create that distance. But at the same time, you know, being able to see the collateral damage, being able to see the civilian casualties, it in some ways keeps, I think, the personal costs of war more at hand.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt that the drone strike pilots go home and sleep any better than those who are, you know, going off to a camp on the battlefield.
Yep. Well, and with that, we're going to take a break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave. We'll be right back for our last segment. Stay tuned.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell. We have Dr. Jason Eberle here with us again. You are now, I think, an honorary caveman. I'm not sure we have to call you a guest anymore. But we're talking about pop culture. We're talking about some movies. And you recently hosted, along with some colleagues, a screening and panel discussion about Eye in the Sky. So the movie about drone strikes. And, you know, very accurate depiction of what is entailed with a drone strike. And then a lot of the kind of moral questions that come around. We talked a little bit about just war theory. We're talking a little bit more specifically about, I think, the ethics of conducting war from a remote location. The you know, drones now, the technology allows us to be able to conduct these types of strikes from, you know, being continents away. But as you pointed out, on the other hand, the technology also brings us in closer to the battlefield and gives us an awareness of the collateral damage, civilian casualties, things like that, that, you know, prior to this technology, a lot of times the combatants would have no idea of what the true cost of conducting war really was. So in the break, we were discussing this, and it kind of leads to some good, solid philosophical debates. You know, one thing I would say is, you know, the drone technology, it allows some distance from the actual theater of combat that allows the psychological toll that warfare necessarily takes on soldiers to be alleviated. It helps preserve our soldiers. It helps preserve what I would call, in some ways, unnecessary psychological toll on our soldiers by allowing them to be remote from the battlefield.
And I would say that from the soldier's perspective, that's a good thing. That, you know, we know about all the problems that soldiers have coming home with PTSD, with, you know, fitting back into society. There's, you know, been suicides and even soldiers, you know, some who have murdered their families. And, you know, we don't necessarily provide the best health care overall, especially mental health care, to our soldiers in dealing with this trauma. So I do think that that's a good thing because, again, for focusing on the soldiers, they're not the ones. They're the agents. They're the ones who are pulling the triggers, but they're under orders. So the true agents of the war are always removed, right? They're always, in our case, because we have a civilian-run military, it's the politicians in Washington, or it's the generals, right?
Often much to the chagrin of the soldiers and people in the military.
Exactly. And so they've always been removed from the quote, the cost of war and the horrors of war. On the other hand, if we do look from that perspective, I do think that there is some benefit to being cognizant of the cost of war because it should make you more reticent to go into war.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. On a global scale, it plays kind of the same role that shame and guilt plays, I think, on an individual level.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I think we were going to bring up, going back to Rogue One, I mean, I think that, that brings up some interesting, you know, the latest Star Wars movie. There's that theme kind of is raised there. What are your thoughts there, Dr.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Rogue One, not only because I'm a huge Star Wars geek, but as a Star Wars movie,
yeah, me too, it's, yeah.
It's, I haven't fully decided where it's going to fit in my ranking order of all the films. Empire's still always at the top, but Rogue One is up there. And probably because it is a different type of Star Wars film. And it's really, it's a classic war film. And it put the wars back in Star Wars.
Yes.
And even like going back and watching The Force Awakens, Episode 7, after having seen Rogue One, it's almost like Force Awakens, I still love it, but it's almost, they're like, that's the kids' movie.
Right,
Rogue One's
right,
for the grown-ups.
Very tame.
You
very
know, as
tame.
My daughter, after she saw Rogue One, you know, I hadn't seen it yet, so she's trying to kind of explain. You know, it's got a different feel. It's but you know, it fits, but it's still got a different. She's like, Dad, it's the Euripides of Star Wars, and after, and after seeing it, I know exactly what she means.
Yeah, I mean, and so again, by putting the wars back in Star Wars, I think again what it does is it shows here's what the cost of the rebellion is. Here's what has to be sacrificed. Again, I'm trying to avoid giving spoilers, but it's got a dark ending. And it shows the nature of sacrifice, but also very much redemptive sacrifice, because the rebels are very cognizant of what they've had to do to battle the Empire. So again, they've got Jus Ad Bellum, got a just cause, mm-hmm. defeat the evil Empire, but do they always exercise Jus in Bello? You know, one of the main characters, he said, I've been an assassin. I've killed people. In fact, he kills someone right at the very beginning of the film.
Right.
You know, arguably for necessary reasons to, you know, smuggle out information, to not get captured and killed himself. If this guy gets captured, he looks like a squealer. So, you know, got to get rid of him. But then, again, it's hard for them to live with that. As we were talking about the drone strike pilots, you know, it's still kind of hard to live with that, especially if you've done it up close and personal.
Yeah, I think that's such an important aspect of why warfare is always the last resort, because it unleashes all sorts of unpredictable violence on both sides, and you quickly, I think, if you look at a major war, you quickly lose sight of how you got into it to begin with, right? Think about like World War One, World War Two, those kinds of things. Once you're in the thick of it, once you're in 1943, you know what I mean? You've got your hands full with what's going on. You're not so concerned about 1939 anymore, no matter how egregious maybe some aggression was then. But the individual combatants find themselves in situations where they often will do things they in other circumstances outside of the theater of war would have never done or imagined themselves doing, but had to do in order to survive. Or often you'll hear those who have been through combat or in battle, you know, in areas of combat zones, will say, you know, it's the brotherhood I feel for the man serving next to me, the man or woman serving next to me. That's my primary concern, right? And so they're more focused on sort of the immediate band of brothers, if you will, mm-hmm. versus the higher, you know, the politicians, the generals, that kind of stuff. And it's the kind of thing where, again, you have all these sorts of unintended consequences that can happen, which, before we run out of time, I do want to ask about, I do think we want to bring up something, and I want to ask you about double effect. Mm-hmm. So we've heard double effect, and could you explain that a little bit, especially sort of in the context of warfare, and maybe even going back to either Rogue One or Eye in the Sky there, I think have some examples of that.
Yeah, so the principle of double effect, it traces back to St. Thomas Aquinas, and again, has been a...
Woo-hoo!
Yeah!
Love Aquinas!
And so, again, it's been one of those...
Notice he didn't say Heidegger, Mark.
You know, earlier in the show...
You wanted to. You wanted to.
Earlier in the show, I was on the verge of bringing up Immanuel Kant. And
those are his guys. Hegel, Kant, and Heidegger. It's like the unholy trio in my mind.
Whereas for me, it's Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas.
There we go.
The triple A's.
Exactly. I even sprinkle Adler on top.
um, So double faith, again, traces back to Aquinas, but again, it's become one of those principles, not only definitive of Catholic moral thinking, but is translated into secular ethical thinking as well.
Comes up in medical ethics all the time.
Oh, right? All the time. And so the principle Aquinas uses in the context of defending oneself from an attacker. And he says, you know, one act can have two, or obviously potentially more, effects. And you're justified in tolerating some sort of negative effect of your action, negative consequence. So you defend yourself from this aggressor while defending yourself, you kill the aggressor. You don't intend the aggressor's death. You're not aiming. It's not what you, quote, directly intend to do. But it is a foreseen side effect of shooting the aggressor to stop them.
You're trying to use enough force to stop the aggressor, and you can foresee that if I'm using a gun to do that, I may kill him.
Right. So there's a difference between, say,
trying to stop him, and then I'm intentionally, once I knock him down and I stop the aggression, I do the coup de grace and finish him off with one to the temple.
Exactly.
Right?
That's not justified by
right,
double effect.
Right.
So the three conditions are, one, you directly intend only the good effect. The negative effect is not a means by which you get around to the good effect.
So the
aggressor's death is not how you save your life. It's getting them down on the ground.
Right.
Incapacitating them. And third, the term proportionality was brought up earlier. It has to be, the negative effect has to be proportional to the good effect.
Right.
You can't shoot someone to keep them from keying your car.
Right.
You can shoot them to keep them from killing you.
So this is, or they shoot their mouth off at you. You can't shoot back with real bullets. Right.
Exactly. You can shoot your mouth back off.
Right.
So this is obviously a major plot point in Eye in the Sky.
Very much
right?
so.
You know, the little girl that's there, the 65% chance that she's going to be killed by this drone strike. You know, she becomes that double effect that they have to kind of weigh and debate about. Is the end result worth, you know, the taking of this little girl's life,
the stopping of the terrorists through they're going to kill the terrorists.
But once again, you know, in theory, this is a justified strike. All other things being equal, you know, this is a justified strike, and her death is acceptable because of the principle of double effect.
Yes, that's in the end what would justify doing the strike. And you know, don't want to spoil anything about whether they actually do the strike, and if they do, whether she dies or not. But yes, speaking conditionally, if they did the strike and if she were to die, it would be justified by that principle, or be justified by utilitarian considerations, which of course is inimical to Catholic moral teaching.
Right.
I like the fact you brought up that word acceptable, which is maybe different, because there could be, it would be acceptable in the fact that there are sufficient justifications. How the public receives it, we also know from photographs that come out of these different combat zones or where crisis and violence have erupted, the social reaction to it may or may not be acceptable, right? There might be, it could be that we're justified in the drone strike, but should the little girl be killed and pictures of that, you know, be released on the internet, there could be kind of a backlash in that could actually then shape the way in which, in the short run, we prosecute war.
Yeah, that's discussed in the film, the quote, political ramifications. And somebody even makes the point, if the terrorists, you know, if we don't bomb the terrorists and they go and blow up a mall, they've done it. We win the propaganda war, it's said.
Oh,
whereas if we do this drone strike and this little girl dies, and like you said, pictures get out and so on, then we've lost the propaganda war. Exactly.
Right. Well, you've had a great time here. I know I have.
And we've covered a lot of ground, too. I mean, we've gone from Westworld to Eye in the Sky to Star Wars. I mean, we've covered a ton of ground.
Did we get to Star Trek?
No, we didn't. No.
Okay, well, we got to have you back, Dr. Jason Eberle from Marion University. Thank you for being with us today, talking using pop culture as a way to get at some very important Catholic philosophical principles. Always great to have you in the cave, and we'll have you back real soon. Thanks for listening.
That's all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. Join us next week, and until then, may God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program,
please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.